We made
this. Hi, I'm Kim Newton, a writer of The X-Files in Season 3. You're listening to The X-Cast.
Hello, and welcome back to another special edition of The X-Cast. I'm Sarah Blair, showrunner and host, here to present another of our episode breakdowns from the archives. It's probably no surprise to anyone who's listened to the show very much that I've chosen to revisit my absolute favorite episode of the entire series, Quagmire. This episode of The X-Files is my quintessential idea of what the show is about. It's got a little bit of everything. Horror, humor, shippiness. The pacing of it all is impeccable. The writing and directing come together along with incredible acting talent and Vancouver atmosphere to create a truly gorgeous piece of television art. I had an absolute blast discussing all of these elements with host Carl Sweeney and fellow guest Zach Moore. And more recently, I also had the immense pleasure of joining Annie Flowers for an interview with the episode's writer, Kim Newton. She was so generous with her time and her stories and answered a lot of burning questions we had about some of the elements in the episode and how it all came together. So without further ado, I present to you out of the archives, Quagmire.
Yeah, the skin's got all these hallucinogenic properties. It lets you see all these really cool visions, and it's supposed to be super spiritual.
Are you even sure that's a toad?
Yeah. It's supposed to...
Hey, guys.
The doors.
What's up?
Hey, dude, you made me drop my toad.
Welcome back to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this, which is our discussion about the 22nd episode of the third season of the X-Files, Quagmire. And I'm joined to mark this occasion by not one southern sensation, but two. I'm joined, first of all, by Sarah Blair. Howdy, Sarah.
Howdy, howdy.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. I've only been waiting 22 years, 4 months, and 12 days for this moment.
It's all downhill after today.
It is, yeah. This is my peak right here.
Yeah. Well, I'm very pleased to be able to bear witness to it anyway. So, Sarah's with me, and also I'm joined by Zach Moore. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I thought I was a big fan of this episode until I became a queen, it was Sarah, and then I realized that I'm just an average fan at this point.
Yeah. So now it's nice to talk to you, Zach, because our paths haven't crossed before, even though we've both been, you know, regular contributors. So yeah, nice to talk to you.
That's true, and all the X casting we have done. I'm glad we finally got to talk about an episode together, Carl.
Yeah, me too. And what an episode it is, of course, because like I said, it's Quagmire, which first aired in May 1996, the 3rd of May to be precise, written and directed by the two Kims. Kim Newton is the scriptwriter and Kim Manners is the director. And of course, Sarah, this is the episode, isn't it, where the agents investigate a missing persons case in Georgia, which Mulder speculates that the disappearances may have been caused by a lake monster called Big Blue. And I'll just say right off the bat that I'm wearing a Big Blue t-shirt that one of our brilliant patrons, Cortland, designed.
Yay, Cortland!
This t-shirt was last worn by me at the Birmingham Podcast Festival. You know, regular listeners will remember hearing me and Tony giving like an authoritative, detailed, and highly accurate description of the X-Files mythology at that festival. And so this t-shirt's a good luck charm, obviously. So... yeah, I mean, Quagmire, where do we even begin? I mean, Sarah, this is your favorite episode, isn't it? That's where we should probably start.
Yeah, by far. I love it because I think it's the most X-Files-y X-Files episode, I guess. I mean, it's just a very good standard textbook episode. and there's, you know, some shipper moments. It's got a little bit of everything. I think it covers the scare factor. It's got some moments of thrills. It's got humor. It's got mood and atmosphere. It's got a monster, several monsters, you know, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, no, you've hit on a lot of what I was going to say, actually. I mean, in terms of a mark out of 10, then, I mean, this is probably fairly predictable, unless you decide to, like, cheat, you know, break the scale. But, yeah, mark out of 10 for this, Sarah.
Yeah.
Is...
Yeah. 12, 15.
Yeah. I mean, how about you, Zach? Because I remember I just recently heard you talking to Tony for the Grotesque episode. Obviously, it was recorded, like, years ago, but it's only just been released. And you say at one point in that episode that Quagmire is one of your favorites. So, yeah, what do you make of it?
Yeah, it's fortuitous how that's finally come back around, my five questions of X. But yeah, I talking about how I kind of got into the X-Files, I did mention that I was a big fan of shows like Unsolved Mysteries and In Search Of, and this kind of cryptozoology, paranormal, supernatural stuff. And the X-Files is like that, just in fictionalized form. So and that's how I got into this whole thing, was there's an Unsolved Mysteries segment on Lake Champlain Champ, the lake monster. So lake monsters were like my window into this whole crazy world. And so the X-Files did an episode about lake monster, and it was so good. And it's perfectly encapsulates what that kind of culture is about, like the people who are looking for the monster, the small towns or breakdowns, who knows, right? They have tourism around it, the colorful characters you find there. So not only that, but I feel like, you know, the Jersey Devil, which I was also on with Tony way back in season one, that was like their Bigfoot episode.
Yeah.
Fail. but they made up for it here with Quagmire. So I'm going to give this one a 9 out of 10.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to give it 8.5 out of 10. But I really like this one. It's not like a knock on it, Sarah, you know. It's just...
That's fair.
Yeah, I'm quite a harsh marker generally, I think. You know, I want to be quite sparing with my 10 out of 10s. But this is really, really good stuff, isn't it? Because... like, the case is memorable enough, I think, but what really kind of brings it up are those character interactions. And it's like Zach said, you've got, like, all these kind of side characters, you know, involved in the tourist industry or whatever, involved in the environment, and they're all really good. But obviously, Mulder and Scully's interactions, I think, is what is particularly strong. But overall, it's just thoroughly entertaining, you know, from start to finish. And something you said, Sarah, reminded me of a review I came across as I was kind of getting ready this morning, by a guy called Robert Shearman, and he said, "This is the X-Files as non-fans imagine it."
Mm. Oh.
Yeah, and that's... I think he's right, you know, because I think that when you talk to people who are aware of the X-Files, but they don't really know that much about it, I think they have this idea in their heads that every week it's, you know, it's Mulder and Scully chasing the monster or whatever. And, you know, this episode is a bit more Scooby-Doo than we're used to. To be honest, in terms of other X-Files episode. But I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean that in, like, you know, it's very charming, you know. Some of the side characters, they're really fun. They're quite broadly drawn, but they're very effective. So, yeah, no, I really like this one. It's a lot of fun, isn't it? It's a lot of fun, Sarah.
Yes, it's a fun ride.
Well, and you mentioned me being on Grotesque a few episodes back. I mentioned in that one that there was some ambiguity to that episode, which I appreciated, and I wish there were in more episodes of the X-Files. And I feel like this one falls under that ambiguity zone as well, because you have like, oh, well, there was a monster, but there was like a proxy monster, you know, and like what was doing this and that, and so there's room for everybody's point of view in this, and I think that's more interesting, because usually the X-Files is like, okay, there are aliens, and Mulder knows about it, but he has to convince everyone else. And episodes like this and Grotesque, it's like, did something happen there, maybe? And then we have that one little kernel at the end, which is like, yes. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there as well.
Yeah. Well, no, we'll definitely get to that final shot, because I think it's actually a point of some debate, I think, with some fans, whether you needed to see Big Blue at the end or not, whether it was wise to do that. But we'll get there. One of the interesting behind-the-scenes things here is like Darren Morgan's involvement, I think. Now, like I said, it's Kim Newton's script, but I think Darren Morgan gave it a rewrite, and I'm not sure to what extent, you know, how much he changed, but it definitely feels of a piece with, like, some of his episodes to me. I mean, Zach, did you pick up on that?
Yeah, I do see this as an honorary Darren Morgan episode, based off of his involvement, and also you have recurring characters like the Stoners, right? They're back, and, you know, Kwee-Kwig is back, yeah, kind of unfortunately wrapping up his... his storyline. but there are elements like that, and then there is that flavor of like a self-aware absurdity in the episode as well. That's so much that Darren Morgan stamped. So I definitely feel like this sits on the shelf with all the rest of his episodes.
Yeah, do you feel the same way, Sarah? Because you've also got stuff like, you know, the absurdity of the way Mulder's portrayed at certain points too, which plays into that, because that obviously is a bit of a touchstone for Morgan's episodes. So, no, it definitely feels like, you know, it has his fingerprints on it, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of scenes that I noticed, especially Dr. Faraday. I feel like a lot of his diatribes have the Darren Morgan stamp on them, and most certainly the conversation on the rock. But just as far as like the characters go, and they all have such rich personalities and ways of speaking that I feel, you know, is significant to his writing style.
Yeah, totally. I mean, do you guys think of this one as a comedy episode? Because I think, like, when we talk about the third season, we talk about the Darren Morgan comedies, you know, with his name on them. And I'm not sure if Quagmire always gets lumped in with those, but it is a very funny episode, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, and I think that it's funny in a way, like, you know, something like Jose Chung or Clyde Bruckman, they're really funny, but they're quite, like, cerebral as well. Whereas this one is a bit more kind of, I don't know if straightforward's the word, but there's kind of a folksy charm to it or something. I don't know. What do you reckon?
Yeah, there's a charm to it. I like that. And then that review you said, like, how a non-fan sees the X-Files, I think that's a perfect summation of it all. But it's not in a bad way, though. You know, it's like this is maybe, if you take a step back, it might be a cliche as far as, like, point by point, but just the execution of it all, so it's so charming. That it really does fit that way. Yeah, there might not be a deeper theme here, you know, as there are in the other ones. But it is an enjoyable journey. And then there are some excellent moments, like the rock conversation, which I know we'll spend a lot of time on when we get to it. So series top 10 series moments right there.
Yeah, and I was also thinking that season 3 is quite a heavy season, really. You know, you got stuff like Grotesque that you talked about, or Oubliette, you know, or episodes where Scully's dealing with the death of her sister. And like I say, there are those other Darren Morgan episodes, but they're a bit more, not intelligent, cerebral is the word I use for. I use that again because I can't think of another one, you know. So I think something like this is a real value.
Even this one has levity, obviously, but they kill a dog, which is like a cardinal sin for me, you know, to kill a dog. So I mean, that, even in the fun episode like this, there's some dark stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sarah, I was going to, before we get to the scene by scene, I wanted to get your take on, like, the location here, really, because it's set in Georgia.
Yes.
And I know Georgia is where you kind of hang your hat, isn't it?
It is.
These days. And I don't know, is this the only X-Files episode set in Georgia? I can't quite remember.
I want to say yes. I'm not totally sure. I live in Georgia, and the episode is technically, like, the first scene opens and it says the Blue Ridge Mountains, which are beautiful. They kind of border Georgia and North Carolina. But Rigdon, Georgia, there's not an actual Rigdon, Georgia. But there's a Rigdon Road down kind of in the south on the close to Columbia, which is on the border of Alabama and Georgia. So on the exact opposite, it's like the opposite most you could get. So you've got northeast Georgia, which is the Blue Ridge Mountains, and then southwest Georgia, which is where, you know, there's the lake, there's Eufaula Lake, and it's really big, which would make more sense, I think, because that's more likely to be where an alligator might be. You know, once you get close to really, really south Georgia, that's where the alligators are coming up from Florida. But up in the Blue Ridge Mountains is probably not likely to have an alligator unless someone let loose a pet and it just kind of hung out and grew for a while. But so it's a beautiful part of the country, but as far as the location goes, I mean, they portrayed the mountains and the lake really beautifully, I thought. And I think, you know, aside, unless you want to be nitpicky about the type of trees in the background,
yeah.
You know, I think it's a good portrayal. It's believable.
Are you saying it's more likely that there is a prehistoric reptile than an alligator in this part of the country, Sarah? That's what you're saying.
Yes. I'm going to go with yes.
I'll tell you what I was thinking about when I was thinking about the locations is that it looked like there was a lot of rain during the shoot for this episode. So I started reading up on the behind the scenes, and what I found out was this was the only time, apparently, that there was a day off for those working on the series because of bad weather. And, you know, according to Gillian Anderson, she said that the rain was so heavy at one point that when they sat down next to a log for a shot, the water was, like, right up to their waists, you know. So probably a pretty miserable shoot in some respects, but the episode is just kind of chock full of, like, atmosphere, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that helps you. I wonder if they had planned to have the rain in the scenes they were in. Okay, guys, it's not that bad. Let's get some umbrellas out there. We can get the scene in today, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because they always keep saying throughout the episode, this is the height of the season. You know, we're going to have this many deaths or whatever. And then it's like raining and there's foggy breath coming out. I'm like, no, this is not the summer season in Georgia. This would be a little bit hotter. Sorry, guys.
But this episode just looks and feels like the kind of X-Files episodes I conjure up in my mind when I first think of the series, you know. I think because this was the time I was really first, like, into the show. You know, because I hadn't really been around much for season one and two. But by this point, I was, like, a regular viewer. Just everything about it. Mark Snow's score, you know, just the general atmosphere. Just really, like, evocative, I thought.
I really liked his use of music. I love, like, those few opening bars when the episode first comes on, it just fills my heart with joy because it's so comforting. It's like my whenever I just need something comforting to put on, it makes me feel nostalgic and happy. I just turn this episode on and I hear that music and oh, it's so good. And I love how I've watched it with my headphones the past couple of times, and I was really paying close attention to the music and the sounds. And it was a lot easier to tell with my headphones on, but it's interesting where he chooses to cut out the music in this episode. It's very, I guess, like, the craft of this episode is so good in all respects, I feel like, but especially the music where, you know, he's got the creepy music and then he cuts the music out and all you can hear is the nature sounds and, you know, something's going to happen. Yeah, the frogs and the crickets and the lapping of the water at the edge of the shore. And then you're like, ooh, this is, you know, getting a little bit creepy. And then everything goes silent. You don't hear anything. And then it's like, oh, something's going to happen. It's so scary. And then you get the attack. And then, like, the music comes back and it's just, like, so intense. Yeah.
Right. I was wondering what you guys think this episode has got on IMDb. I don't know if you guys have looked, but if you haven't,
I looked, so I can't.
Oh,
sorry.
I have not looked, and as has been my experience, IMDb, it's not a ranking of 10. It's between like 6 and 9, basically.
Yeah.
So, I'm gonna say this one has an 8 on IMDb. 8.3 is gonna be my guess.
Oh my god, that's exactly right.
Oh,
amazing.
I promise you guys, I did not look. I swear. So.
Yeah, 8.3.
I'm just that good.
Yeah, fantastic. That's from about 2,500 ratings at the time of recording. I mean, what I also like to look at as well is, like, if you line up all the episodes for a particular season, like, how highly do you reckon this one ranks? Sarah, did you look at that or not?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so where do you think the fans have put this one?
I would say relatively high.
Hmm.
Ish.
Go on, stick your neck out. Put
out of what, 22? How many episodes?
24 in total.
24 in total. I would say it's probably like one being the number one highest.
Yes,
I'd say it's in top 10.
Okay, Zach, do you want to venture, I guess?
I mean, season 3 is a very strong season, so it's hard to... I'm going to say 9 out of 20... whatever it was.
Yeah, I was surprised by the answer here because it only came 13th out of 24.
13th? Ooh.
Wow. And
again, season 3 is a very strong season.
It is.
So that doesn't surprise you that much, to be honest.
Yeah.
No, and I think it's like the mythology episodes had particularly high scores on this season, you know. So that's like 7 episodes immediately. And then you've got the like the Darren Morgan episodes, Pusher. Any other season this would have been like much higher, I think.
Yeah.
But still, 13th seemed a little low. It seemed a bit unfair to me. But hey, there we go. With all that being said, I think, guys, we should take a bit more of an in-depth look at this episode. All right, then. So we meet in the teaser, don't we? We meet Dr. Faraday, who's talking about... He's talking to another doctor, Dr. Bailey, about the declining frog population. He uses the term frog holocaust at one point.
Frog holocaust. I have that in my notes. I'm like, really, man? Can we tone it down a bit? That's a little extreme.
Well, he was very, like, strident, wasn't he? You know?
Yeah.
He was almost like a parody of the character he's supposed to be, which made you feel like more like a Darren Morgan episode than other things, I'd say.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little of... It's not quite in the same vein, but the way War of the Coprophages starts with, like, the cockroach exterminator.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. You start with, like, a professional who can speak, you know, at length, passionately about a subject or whatever. That seemed like a Morgan trait to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think at one point he tosses out the line, you can't turn your back on nature, or nature will turn her back on you.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
Which will be very relevant, won't it? Basically what happens is the other guy gets attacked. At one point we get, like, a POV shot, and, like, there are things all through this episode that remind me of Jaws, which I assume you guys have seen, but I'm not mm-hmm. sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Sarah, have you seen Jaws?
Yes.
Yeah, so you know the way in Spielberg's film, he couldn't really show the shark as much as he wanted to initially because it was kind of malfunctioning and all that stuff. So you get a lot of POV shots from the shark's perspective.
Yeah.
And here we get it, don't we? It's to kind of obscure the fact it's an alligator, I guess. You know.
Yeah.
But we got a few of them, don't we, through the episode?
Yeah. I really did love those shots throughout the episode. I think it added a nice little creep factor to it.
I mean, what did you guys think of this teaser? Because, I mean, I'll tell you what I thought this time was. I was trying to remember seeing the episode for the first time, and I was wondering if I knew. Like, I think at this point, you could imagine it's an episode all about killer frogs, couldn't you? Because the teaser closes with, like, a shot of a frog, I think.
And that gurgling he makes when he, like, gets... Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, no, it was a very effectively shot opening because you see, like, the rack focus to this frog sitting on a log, and then he jumps off, and you think, is this going to be a... Yeah, you think that's going to be the double twist, right? It's like a monster frog, right? Nature's getting back at you or something, right? I don't know, but I'm glad they didn't go that route. But I thought it wasn't a very effective teaser, yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would give anything to see a monster frog episode of The X-Files, I'll be honest.
Say that for the comic books or something.
After the credits, though, or after the opening titles, we get Mulder and Scully driving, don't we? And, of course, Queequeg on the back seat. And this is a nice little scene, I think. You know, it's where they're driving past a series of big blue signs. And, you know, we get the backstory about it's a missing persons case. You know, what, Mulder, why are you so interested in this, etc., etc.? And Scully's like, tell me you're not serious when she sees that big blue sign.
Oh, yeah. The gradual reveal of the billboards is so smart because you say, what's bigger than the sky and older than the mountains? And you're like, what is this going to be? That's how Scully finds out what they're looking for. She's like, are you serious? This is classic X-Files, too. Like, Mulder calls Scully in the middle of middle of the morning, middle of the night, right? And, like, they fly out somewhere, and she doesn't know what they're there for. Mulder is so disrespectful of Scully without telling what they're there to do, right?
I mean, I think there's something we need to get on the table, though, guys, here. Sarah, you don't like Queequeg, do you? You know, that's
adorable dog. I'm not going to let you know what I have written in my notes.
I call
Queequeg through the whole of my notes. Dear. But yeah.
I just don't understand this. I think he's one of the most charming, like, recurring characters we've ever had, to be honest. So you just don't like little dogs. Is that it?
No. I mean, well, I have a chihuahua, so I like little dogs. I prefer them over big dogs. But, like, the buggy-eyed, barky ones are just, I don't know. Like, my chihuahua is pretty chill for a chihuahua, and he's, you know, he's pretty, but the fluffy one and the little brat dog, like, runs off on Scully when she's trying to give it a bath and, like, gets soap and water all over the place in the cockroach episode. I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but yeah. I mean, and even Gillian Anderson mentioned that she hated the dog because it kept farting all the time, and, like, it just... And it's just, like, so yippity and just into everything, and that is just not my favorite dog. I'm a Dagoo fan, for sure. That's where my loyalties lay.
I must say, Zach, I just have a hard time thinking that, you know, later on, when we get Queequeg versus the alligator, you know, Sarah's rooting for the alligator, basically.
I can't even. I love all dogs, right? But I will say... I see what you're saying, Sarah. Like, if I had my pick of dogs, this would be near the bottom of the list as far as this breed. This
he ate like, his owner. I mean, well, okay, well, it's
out
just...
of necessity, you know?
Yeah, it was already dead. He was already dead, or she was already dead, you know? What more could have happened to her?
Speaking of... Speaking of cannibalism, we've got dog eating. Like, what if Scully was shot in her apartment and then Queequeg was like, oh, hey, I'm going to have a snack. Like, that would be so horrible. We don't want that.
Well, Scully's immortal, isn't she? So, you know.
Well, yeah. I will say this about Queequeg in this episode. I wonder if this is something that Darren Morgan added in, like when he was, you know, helping out with the script to say kind of wrap up that little subplot of Scully having a dog this season. I wish they hadn't wrapped it up the same way, but, you know, I'm glad that he saw that as a dangling thread.
I've seen an interview with Morgan somewhere. I think it was around about the time of season 10 when he was doing interviews for the Were-Monster episode. And he said, you know, on reflection, there are a couple of things he would have done differently, you know, on the original run of the series, which was like, one of them was in War of the Coprophages. There was a scene originally where David Duchovny's mother had a cameo. And he cut it out, you know, completely brutal, like, oh, it doesn't really serve the episode, you know, we need a bit of time, let's cut her out. And he said, you know, in hindsight, he'd be a bit more mellow, you know, it would have been nice for him, for his mother to be in the series and stuff like that. And I think he also said about the dog, you know, as an older man, he looks back on it and he sort of regrets having to be so cruel to Queequeg, basically. But we'll talk more about his death in a little while, I think, but...
Yeah.
I mean, the agents get to Dr. Faraday's lab, don't they? Where, you know, he doesn't seem upset at all, does he? He also doesn't believe in Big Blue, which is interesting. He's like, whenever an issue requires any real thought, people turn to UFOs and Sasquatches. And he talks about pseudoscientists with nothing better to do than chase fairy tales as well.
He destroys Mulder's entire life work in, like, two sentences.
And I love... My favorite part about that scene is Mulder and Scully exchanging their shade behind his back while he's just talking. And he's, like, describing Mulder perfectly. And Scully's just, like, rolling her eyes, like, this is exactly what I've been trying to tell you forever, Mulder. And he's just...
Well, yeah, it's funny because I was trying to think, because there's a character who turns up a bit later who's kind of a Mulder surrogate, the guy Ansel, you know, the photographer. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to engineer an argument. I was going to come on and say Dr. Faraday is kind of like a Scully stand-in, you know, and it's a bit of a reach, but there's a couple of things I'm going to point to as we go through the episode. But like, he's so kind of strident. He seems slightly kind of similar to me to early days Scully, really, season one, where she would like be just brutal in their rebuttals to Mulder. You know, there wasn't quite the same back and forth, but you know, there's that gif where she says, it's a folktale, a myth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Am I reaching? I think I'm reaching, aren't I? What
no, because I'm throughout the episode, and there's like certain parts that I'll mention, but especially, you know, this is kind of one of the first ones where she's talking about, and like even the conversation in the car, she's talking about, you know, it could be a serial killer or whatever, and I felt like she kind of goes through and sort of debunks things the same way she did in the cockroach episode over the phone. There's a lot of that echoing to me throughout this episode.
To the point that she's just being obtuse about it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a guy, there's a body, half of a body. Like, you know, fish. And Mulder has to say, like, are fish also known for, you know, eating half and saving half for later? You know, it's like, come on, Scully, open your eyes. You know,
at some point.
But because it has this kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of charm flavor to it, this episode, it does work. It doesn't annoy me or anything.
Yeah,
well, because we get one of those classic Mulder and Scully scenes where they kind of debate, like, the basis of, like, the paranormal element, don't they? It's outside the tackle shop. We're talking about sea monsters and lake monsters and so on. And I think at one point Scully says, like, you know, these are just folk tales born out of some collective fear of the unknown, you know. Mm-hmm. Zach, I tell you what I was thinking. It was back to what you said earlier about, like, how they did a fail, basically, with Jersey Devil. And this whole Big Blue concept, it feels to me that it feels a bit more like something that they would have done in season one, really. But if they'd have done this in season one, they'd have done it completely straight, I think. They'd have been really earnest about it. And it would have sat, you know, alongside episodes like Jersey Devil and Shapes, which most people don't recognize.
I've been on both those episodes.
Yeah, the thing that makes it work is that it's delightful that it's done with a bit of a lighter touch here, isn't it? Otherwise, it could have just been like a bit of a dud, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad they saved it to three when they were kind of, you know, this is X-Files at its peak, right? These prime seasons, these middle seasons of the show. So absolutely, I think you had to approach it with a self-awareness and a, you know, kind of wink and a tongue-in-cheek. Because, again, straight, perfectly said, if it's straight up, then you're going to get a Shapes, so you're going to get a Jersey Devil, yeah. And you don't want that. To your point, kind of times, because the next character we meet is like the gift shop owner guy, right? Him, the photographer we mentioned, the scientist we were talking about earlier. These guys are all like just perfect parts of like this tapestry of like this. When you have these small towns who have the Boggy Creek Monster or whatever, right? These kind of guys. These are the characters. You have your scientists who think everybody's crazy and an idiot. You have your people who are just, you know, their entire life it just revolves around this, like, trying to find evidence, and you have your guys like the shop owner here who just profits off the whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's great. They showed all the facets of what the culture around these, you know, alleged monsters is.
Yeah, it was great because, like, they're not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily like the most three-dimensional characters, but they've got a bit of liveliness to them, haven't they? They're quite deftly kind of sketched in and well-performed as well, I think helps. So, yeah, what did you make of the tackle shop owner, Sarah? This is the guy who has, like, shows your bobbers on his hat.
Yes, he's my favorite. I love him. Mark Atchison. He's an elf, too, and came back as the truck driver in My Struggle 4.
Nice call.
I love that hat. I want that hat on my head because it's just, I don't know why it cracks, it's like completely terrible, but I just love it because I love this episode. I want to just live in that gift shop and buy everything. Just go, like, if this was a real thing, I would just go up to Rigdon, Georgia and just go buy all of the stuff. But I think one of the things I really love is he plays the personality of the guy so well, and his accent is so authentic. And just, you know, he's like, his daddy's cattle got eaten. Makes me laugh every time. And I love this story, how it really establishes the town, like you said, Zach, and each of the characters in the town. And you know, it really kind of builds up suspense and lets you know a little bit about how the people operate here, and that they all believe that this is, you know, they say, like, I don't know, you have to decide for yourself, but this is my story and this is what I know happened. So, you know, they all kind of believe except for Dr. Faraday.
And, like, one person who definitely believes is Ansel, who enters the shop, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if Mulder's sister being abducted is Mulder's, like, trauma, then Ansel's dad had a cow, had a cow that got eaten. Yeah, so I think that's his trauma.
Yeah,
he really is taking his parallel pretty far.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the other parallel will be you really quickly get this sense, don't you, that his quest, he's on Ansel. Like, one day I'm going to get my proof, or, you know, that kind of thing.
One day I will be in the right place at the right time and I will snap a shot of that monster. It's like, okay, Ansel, let's talk about foreshadowing here. Do you know what that is? Because it just happened.
Well, there's kind of a sadness about it, isn't there? Because, like, with Mulder, he's off on all these adventures and stuff, so he's kind of glamorized. But with someone like Ansel, it's a bit more kind of authentic, isn't it? I don't know. I just felt kind of sad for him, really.
Yeah, if Mulder existed in the real world, he'd be more like this guy. Totally.
Yeah. Or he'd be more like the lone gunman, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like Max Fennig. Yeah.
Right. And that was part of a brief 30-second tangent. That was part of the brilliance, I thought, of season 10, where you first meet Mulder again. And he has become this kind of guy. He's got the tape over his computer camera, right? He has become this lone gunman kind of character. And that's a slipper that Scully keeps him from turning into these people. And God bless her for that.
So. Yeah.
All right, so they go to the lake because
the guy walks in. He goes, "We got a floater."
Yeah, this is the one you were talking about, isn't it, Zach? Where the guy's like half eaten from the from the waist downwards. He's still there.
But thank God he wore his Boy Scout troop master, and he was wearing his Boy Scout belt buckle. And that's how he was easily identifiable, even
and
floating in the water.
Didn't Mulder get the wallet out of his back pocket too? I think so.
I mean, I was more preoccupied in this scene, like, just how much rain there was. I think this is one of the scenes where it's, like, just chucking it down, you know.
Yeah.
But, like, that lake is a really, like, nice location, and just the cinematography and the atmosphere here was just perfect for what they were going for, really, you know.
Mm-hmm. the mood. And I love the, in this shot, they have the big blue inflatable on top of the building that I really yes. want for my house. I don't think we could get HOA approval for that, but I'm still working on it.
Yeah, you're going to get some notes from the Homeowners Association.
Yeah. Yeah. A girl can dream, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I paid close enough attention, sadly.
I've only seen this episode about 500 times. You notice things.
But this is when they find the legs and the bottom half of his body floating there, and Scully's like, oh well, you know, this is a lots of boats are coming around here. It could be a propeller accident. Fish eat half the body. It's like, come on, Scully, someone bit this man in half. Can you just agree on that?
I love how she says we eat fish and fish eat us, and you're like, well, that's kind of logical, except you know.
Except he's clearly been bitten in half. Yeah. I mean, it's back to what we were saying about like this being an episode. Kind of like representing the X-Files as non-fans think of it. Because I think a lot of people think Mulder and Scully go back and forth, and she says something ridiculously, you know, it's not applicable to the case. Mulder's always right. And I think that's kind of the vein we're in here, isn't it? You know, where it's a bit kind of, I don't know if it's on the nose exactly, but it's not the most subtle of kind of interactions, I suppose. But it's a lot of fun, is the thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And I love right after the scene, they've got the three shots of the lake for atmosphere, and they don't really, I haven't much seen that in any other episode, but I'm glad that they included those shots because they're, first of all, they're just plain old pretty, you know, the bird and the lighthouse or, you know, in the lake, and it just kind of like slows the episode down and kind of makes you like pause just for a couple of seconds, but I love that part.
That or they were just short on time. They had to pass the episode out, probably.
I mean, I'm thankful for it for whatever reason it was in there. Cause I love
put
it.
Some of that Canadian stock footage in there, guys. Yeah, 30 seconds short.
I think the next thing we see is the shop owner out laying footprints, don't we? And this kind of reminded me in a way of like Mulder being, you know, when he goes out squatching in season 11, kind of.
His hoax goes downhill quick.
Well, this is perfect, though, because this is exactly what I'm talking about, this tapestry of these towns and with monsters and stuff. There's always somebody out there, like, either trying to cause a hoax to just get attention or to, like, maintain the legend. Because, obviously, this dude runs this gift shop, right? His livelihood is selling the legend of Bleak Blue, so he's going to go out there and make sure there's still, you know, stuff going on. There have been stories of people faking so many fake photographs or films or footprints or all that. So I love how they even incorporated that thread of the cryptozoology into this. Even if it's a silly thing, or the guy is giant, like, alligator feet, whatever he was wearing. So. Yeah.
He's got maps to sell.
It doesn't work out well for him, though, does it? He gets kind of his comeuppance because he gets attacked.
Yeah.
And, like, we get another of these nice little characters turn up the next day, don't we? Because we get the sheriff arrive. You know, and this guy just reminds me of the mayor in Jaws who didn't want to close the beach, you know.
Exactly. It's exactly what I thought. Mulder's like, we got to close this lake. He's like, oh, this is big season. Like you said, Sarah, like it's raining. Like there's no one here. What are you talking about, big season? But there's always that theme. Like I've never seen Lake Placid. I guess I maybe should have in preparation for this episode. But I assume it's a similar deal, right? Jaws, you know, whenever there's a body of water and people are dying and some, you know, level-headed person wants to shut down, you know, shut it down. It's like, oh no, we got tourists coming in. We got to keep the shores open. So that's another conflict now that's happening in the episode.
In the beginning of the scene, I love the part where Ansel and Mulder are kind of, you know, huddled around this footprint, and Mulder's like really excited about it, and Ansel, you know, says, like I said, I recognize his hat. And Mulder goes, how could you not? It's not one that you catch right away, but you know, when you watch it as many times as I have.
I did want to mention that the sheriff who shows up here is played by actor Chris Ellis. He's a really well-known character actor. He's seen like Armageddon or Transformers, Dark Knight Rises. Like, he's in all kinds of stuff. So he's one of those guys where you might not know his name, but when he pops up, you're like, I know that guy. He's one of those guys.
So I think they discover the shop owner's boots, don't they? That's kind of what happens.
Yes, the fake feet.
Yeah, that's right. And then, I mean, the following scene, we get the return of the stoners from War of the Coprophages, who will also reappear many years later in Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster.
Carl, is it okay if I say one thing about the sheriff really quick?
Yeah, go for it.
I love how when Scully comes down the hill and she's got the sheriff, she's like, Mulder, this is Sheriff Hint, and he comes up and he says, Agent Mulder, is it Mulder? Like, it makes me laugh every time because this is basically when the X-Files was the height of everything. And you've got this guy who clearly is like, who are you? Like, I don't know who you are. I don't really care who you are. And it cracks me up. But yeah, that's all I had to say.
That's all right. No worries. Yeah. I mean, I obviously haven't watched this episode enough because you're saying all these lines and I've got no recollection of them whatsoever. But yeah, no, that's good. I mean, the stoners, they're talking all about how like licking frogs gives you like kick-ass hallucinations and stuff like that. I mean, anyone know if this is true?
I want to say
it kicks open
yes.
the doors of your perceptions and swings them wide open, man, is what they say.
Yeah.
No, I've never tried that.
Streets and roads along the way.
Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, that's what that's based off of, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of those guys gets attacked, you know, sadly. So,
The guy, this random snorkeling dude comes out in the middle of this lake and scares the toad away, and then he's like, dude, and then he like gets grabbed from something underneath. It's so scary, because you don't know what it is. Is it a lake monster? Maybe. And
is it a giant frog? Maybe.
Maybe. And I love how they're standing there watching this guy get attacked, and they're just like, oh, dude. and then you get the shot and you see his head bob up, and then it turns to the side and his head is chomped off, and it's just so creepy, and it's like, oh, special effects.
Sarah, that's clearly a boating accident. There's all high traffic area,
so much traffic.
Standard procedure for boat propellers to decapitate someone in such a manner. I don't know what you're talking about.
I know.
Yeah, but Scully says, yeah, all that stuff about propeller damage. But she also says, like, regardless of what I believe, there's no hard evidence, but it's what you believe.
Yeah.
You
know. And then the sheriff's like, we've got Freebird and Moon Unit over here. I don't know what they saw. But clearly they are unreliable witnesses.
It was nice to see those characters anyway, I suppose.
Still doing their thing.
Yeah. On their way to Lauderdale. Because that's what you do, is lick toads in the middle of the mountains in Georgia on your way to Lauderdale.
I mean, we get another attack quite quickly, don't we? Because like Ansel then is like, he's waiting for a good fight opportunity. There's a nice shot, I think, when the tire on the lake starts to like bob up and down. That was a good little touch. And he's attacked again, isn't he? So, you know.
I have a question for you guys. So do you think Big Blue and this alligator are double teaming things throughout the episode?
Okay. I wanted to ask you that as well. Like, not to jump the gun, but obviously we have Big Blue... As it's understood, right, this plesiosaur, and then you have the giant alligator, and because in some of these shots, it's like, I don't think an alligator could get this point of view perspective.
Yeah.
This is one of the shots, probably why you brought it up here. So, I don't know, I thought, for the longest time, Sarah, I thought there was a little bit of both going on, but honestly, I think there's a through line where, no, the alligator ate the frogs are dying off, the alligator had to start eating people, and that's why it escalated so quickly. I think, you know, Big Blue being there is just... has no connection to anything that happens in this episode.
Well,
that's ultimately what I came to my last time I watched it.
Well, this is my thought, because I think... So I think all of the attacks on the humans are the alligators. I feel like Big Blue is having fun with everybody and is just kind of playing around. So when we get to this next scene where they're, you know, throwing the hooks in the lake and dragging the lake and all that, and then when the sheriff gets pulled in, I think that's Big Blue. Because, you know, and she, like, brushes up against, you know, and it's like, hey, you guys are annoying me with all these hooks in my lake here. Like, I'm going to just yank you in really quick and then,
you know, you say that, and I think that's a good point. That possibly. I think that's a strong maybe. I'll
give
you that one. But now that we're talking about it, the boat being sunk in a minute here is probably the real big... I don't think an alligator could have done that.
No.
So, or just Scully's a terrible boat driver.
Well, yeah, I thought it was that she drove into the rock. You know.
Well, I thought so too, but...
She explains it away that way. She's like, oh, it's my fault. I'm like, okay, Scully, a sea monster sunk your boat. You're going to go down with the ship literally and say it was your fault to not admit there's a sea monster
just
here.
Just in denial. Right. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I think there's arguments for the... Because that's what I thought for a long time, was that it was the rock that she hit, but then... You know, it's like it's a stone throw. He's like walking on the shore, so the boat wouldn't have sank. Like, that never made sense to me. But we'll get to that later.
The ambiguity of episodes. See, that's what I love about these kinds of episodes. You'd have the discussion about what was what, when, and where, and who did what. You know, you don't know.
Exactly.
Well, my take on it was, my initial feeling is that the alligator is responsible for all the attacks.
Yeah.
And that we just happened to get this shot of Big Blue at the end. So he is there. I do like Sarah's take that the Big Blue's this kind of prankster. And he's like, he's playing games with the humans. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. And then, so then you've got the sheriff and he's like, I'm not at all convinced we're dealing with an aquatic menace. That's lying.
And then immediately he's like, we gotta get the National Guard down here right now.
Yeah. Hey, get the National Guard. Call everybody. It pushed to get something. It was something big.
That's so funny. The way he's dragged in, he just changes his tune immediately. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. My goal one day is to go to Vancouver and stand on that shore and have my picture taken. It will happen.
I really want to go to Vancouver. And I've just seen that on the Eat the Corn website, Kimon's, he did a trip and he's put up some photos about, like, you know, he's been to all these locations that are in the series and stuff. So
that's fun. I'll just have to remember to make sure I take the lens cap off before I get my picture taken.
Well, this is it, because they're at the motel, aren't they, or a lodge or wherever it is they're staying, and they're looking through Ansel's photos, you know. And this reminded me of the scene in Where Monster, where Mulder's looking at the smartphone photos he's kind of taken, you know. And, like, it's all this stuff, isn't it? Like, could this be a tooth? And again, it's like this link with Mulder, isn't it? Where, you know, Mulder's been, like, trying to amass this evidence of the paranormal, and he's got quite close, but he doesn't really have anything tangible, necessarily, he can kind of point to, you know. So Ansel equals Mulder, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and Scully even calls him out, you know, on that. He's like, you know what I see when I look at those? I see you, Mulder, in the future. You know, and that's exactly what we're talking about. You know, it's like, if not for Scully, he would totally fall down this rabbit hole being this weird, introverted, just guy who's looking for conspiracies and monsters everywhere.
15 years of fruitless hunting, and all the guy's got is a blurry picture of the monster's tooth.
But that's what it's like, though. Yeah. Like, again, the pictures, like, this is the Unsolved Mysteries in Search of Specials I've seen. They're like, here's our best evidence of the Loch Ness Monster. And it's like, this, that's it? That's all you got? Like, I love this stuff, guys, but give me something more concrete. Come on. I want to believe. But yeah. Come on. Give me a good picture.
Well, yeah, even to the point, like, there's been a news story in the last couple of weeks, you know, that, you know, the most convincing photo of the Loch Ness Monster in years has been taken. And then I had a look at it. And it's just like this, like, black smudge, you know, above the surface of the water. And I just think, I don't know, if there was anything there. I mean, they do say in this episode that the Loch Ness Monster is believed to live in the cliffs, actually. But you'd think that people would be able to find it, wouldn't you? If there really was, like, something.
Smartphones and all that today. It's just, yeah. But anyway.
So Scully takes Squeak out for a walk, doesn't she?
Can I just say how much of a badass she is? Like, when Mulder's like, do you want me to come with you? And she just, like, shows him her gun. She's like, I'm a badass.
Yeah, well, they didn't save Queequeg.
No, it didn't. It didn't work out, though, did it? Because, yeah, Queequeg runs off. You know, I quite like this scene in terms of, like, suspense and stuff. Eventually, his collar kind of reels back, and he's gone. Scully's shocked.
I mean, okay, when I first saw this episode, I will say I was completely shocked and horrified that the dog actually got eaten. Like, that was, like, what even? I'm not completely heartless. I know I like to play this up, but I was like,
Sarah.
Like,
there's hope for you yet.
They really killed the dog? Like, what? They really killed the dog. The dog got eaten. Not just killed, but eaten. And... like the it always drives me nuts because I have the same kind of leash for my dog, and you can retract that by yourself. You don't have to wait for the dog to come back to you. I mean, I know it's very dramatic to have the leash come back. I love that about it. But I mean, if my dog was, like, squealing and getting eaten, I would be yanking on that leash, like, get it back, you know, like, get my dog back. But I guess she was just too stunned and horrified at what was going on. Like, I mean, I know I wasn't breathing when I was watching that, but yeah.
Well, she certainly didn't believe there was a monster of any kind in the lake. That's true. So she had nothing to be concerned about.
That's true.
This is true. I mean, I'll tell you what I like about it is that, you know, a bit later they talk about, you know, you forget when you live in the city about nature and stuff like that. So I like the idea that Queequeg's like this city dweller of a dog, isn't he? You know, he's adapted to his, like, urban environment. He's, you know, he's been eating his owners and stuff. And then you put him back in the wild, put him back in, you know, in this environment, and he's, you know, he's not up to it, is he? He's
and kind leave of, it, leave it to a little dog to go after something that's bigger than themselves. I mean, that's how little dogs are.
And I'll tell you what made me laugh as well is, like, the next scene when Mulder's like, I'm sorry about Queequeg. He waits like half a second and then he's like straight back into the photos, you know?
that's some old one. I was like, so anyway, I've said my, you know, partner obligated condolences to you. Let's get back to the case.
I mean, he's not a bad guy, is he? But he's clearly has to make an effort with these kind of interactions, I think, is the sense I get. It's like in the when Scully's got cancer, in the episode Elegy, he kind of comes into her apartment and he like starts talking about the case immediately. He has to kind of check himself and say, oh, sorry, how was the doctors or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm. He's one track mind. That's how he is.
He's trying
to be sympathetic. And then I love the last line in that scene. He's looking at her and she's completely traumatized and horrified at what just happened to her dog, holding the bloody collar for Pete's sake, chewed up. And he's just like, can you drive a boat? You're like, Mulder, come on, give her a minute. Like, just chill yourself out here, buddy. Like, I know this quest is important to you, but...
No, I really liked how Gillian Anderson played this scene where she's just, like, completely just in shock about what has happened and completely tuned out everything Mulder is saying because he tells her all this stuff and he goes up to her and he's like, did you get that? And she's like, yeah, could you repeat the last part? He's like, what part? All of it after I'm sorry?
Poor Scully.
Yeah, poor Scully. I mean, they do go out on the boat, though, like you say. Mm-hmm. So, again, this reinforced the Jaws connection to me.
And the boat's named after Kim Manners's mom's wife, Patricia Ray. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope they got boat insurance. Gosh.
I know they lost their deposit.
And I like the stuff here. I don't know about you guys, where it's all about, they talk about, like, cartographers used to have maps that said, like, here be monsters. Yeah. And like Mulder says, you know, I used to have a map in New York City just like that.
Yeah, good stuff.
And he says, I know the difference between expectation and hope. I like that line.
Well, I think the point is that, like, we kind of latch on to, like, the conversation on the rock, of course, but all these scenes are, like, really well written too, aren't they, I think? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, this is a great episode of the two of them, two of theirs interplay with each other, absolutely.
Mm. And, of course, they have the collision, possibly Big Blue kind of messing around with them, possibly a rock, who knows? Mayday.
I'm going to vote for Big Blue.
Yeah, me too.
Let's have a vote. Okay, so Sarah, Big Blue, maybe Blue. What do you say, Carl?
I say rock. I'm with Scully on this one.
Scully over here again.
Sorry, guys.
I love how she asks about 4 or 5 times, what is that, Mulder? Like, she's actually, like, really scared for once. She's, like, not playing it cool.
Yeah. And, of course, the boat sinks. And, I mean, when we talk about the conversation on the rock, it's kind of two scenes, really, isn't it? It's kind of... This first scene, they talk about various things where it's like, they discuss like swimming to shore. This is where they talk about the difference between getting back to nature and living in the city. Scully says like, Mulder, what are you hoping to accomplish? You know, she compares him to Ansel. He represents your future. And she's like, I can't really figure out your reasons for like what you're doing, Mulder, to be honest. So that's the first part of the scene, isn't it? Yeah, this is all good stuff.
I think I actually, you know, because there is, right, as we'll get into, right, it's the conversation on the rock, right? All the X-Files fans.
I have it, like, splashed across the page of my notes here. Also, can I just mention really quickly how much I love the shot of the boat sinking and revealing them standing on the rock? It's just, I love that shot. But yeah, go ahead.
But no, it's a great shot. Absolutely, Commander's a great director, as we know. But like you were saying, Carl, it's kind of a two part conversation. And I'm gonna go against the grain here and say I think I actually like the first part of it better than the second part. Just because it's more about like Mulder's whole journey, you know, and his and like the whole concept of the X-Files period. You know, like, what are we even doing? You know, like, what is this about? You know, I like that kind of having an existential crisis about their career choices and what they do. And, of course, the second part is more just, like, the emotional connection between them and all that. And I'm all about that. But it was interesting that it was kind of divided into two parts. I hadn't kind of in memory. I hadn't really. I thought it was just one big, long conversation with all that in there. There is a little bit of a pause between the two.
Yeah, I'd forgot that. I thought it was just one extended scene. And, of course, we get the moment where they're attacked. Not attacked, but the duck appears.
Yeah. Okay. And there's the really splashing, tough. Too, which I also think is Big Blue.
So he's kind of in cahoots with the duck, is it?
The
kind
of,
the duck has that classic, like, you know, Loch Ness monster profile, you know, coming through the fog. I was like, see, there it is, you know? It's all tied together.
Is there anything else, Sarah, about this first conversation you wanted to talk about before we move to the second part of it?
Yeah, the living in the city, you forget night is actually so dark, and then Scully says living in the
which
city
is really true.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Mm-hmm. And then you know, I thought it was interesting how she mentions, like, you're always afraid of being mugged or hit by a car, which I kind of think is telling as far as, you know, Scully goes. Like, that's her fear of living. Like, she's thinking about those things, you know, being mugged or whatever, being in D.C. and all that. And Mulder's out there afraid of aliens and government conspiracies. He's not too concerned about being mugged. But, you know, and then she mentions her, did you guys say about her dad's quote that it's not until you get back to nature that you realize everything is out to get you? And she says, that's why my father always taught me to respect nature, because it has no respect for you, which is kind of a throwback to Dr. Faraday's quote at the beginning. I always get those two mixed up when I try to quote them, but yeah.
I mean, in terms of, like, the second part of it, I really like the way it's the way they're posed, really. You know, like, Scully's kind of seated, isn't she? Mulder's kind of led back, shivering, which is really good. And then they get into the discussion of cannibalism, first of all, isn't it?
Yeah.
You lost some weight, Scully, haven't you?
Yeah.
I think it's then they start to talk about Queequeg, isn't it?
Why she named him Queequeg, right?
And before that, Mulder says, you know, he says, this creature exists in the earthly confines of this lake, and I want to find it. He's, like, so adamant about this. And it's like, Mulder, you know, like, he's, like, I guess in my rewatches now, and most recently in the past maybe year or so, I've realized how arrogant Mulder really is to think that there's been this monster existing for thousands of years in this lake. Nobody else has seen it. Nobody else has found it. But he's going to be the one to find it. You know, like, that's he really believes that he's going to be the one after thousands of years. And later on, you know, he says, like, this, you know, Faraday mentions that he's been on the lake for 3 years studying these frogs, and he's never seen hide nor scale of Big Blue. Mm-hmm. And Mulder's like, well, it's a prehistoric animal that's, like, been hiding for thousands of years. Of course you're not going to find it. It knows how to hide. And you're like, Mulder, but you think you're going to be the one to find it. Okay, that's fine, Mulder. You go ahead. So I'm with Scully on this subject matter. Like, she's just, like, rolling her eyes. And this whole, like, the Scully shade in this episode is so strong. I love it. But, yeah.
Well, that's why I like that first half maybe better than the second half, because I think it speaks to the show. Because he's like, we investigate so many things that aren't tangible, you know, that ghosts, aliens, right? But it's like, there is a creature here in this lake. Like, if you just spend all your time and resources in this one area, you have a heck of a lot better chances than, like, catching UFO or you know, a ghost or something like that. So I get it's tangible. I like that. So anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I like Mulder's ego, you know, egocentric kind of pursuit of Big Blue, really, because I think it ties in nicely with, like, the comparison they make with Ahab from Moby Dick, you know, where he's, like, this so driven, and, like, everything takes on, like, a warped significance for him and stuff like that. But what's interesting is Mulder kind of pushes back on it, isn't it? Because he says, you know, I really want a peg leg, you know, like, if I had a peg leg, he sort of says it would be heroic enough just to survive. You know, so the kind of implication is he'd be a bit more kind of chilled, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just it's a nice little back and forth, isn't it?
Yeah. And I as a teenager, when I was first watching this episode, that totally spoke to me, because I was just like, yes. I mean, I don't want to be a grown up and have to adult. And even now, it's like, I kind of understand that, but I think it's pretty disrespectful. At this point, but, you know, he's blaming his search for the truth on the patriarchy. If you could just earn a living and wear a necktie, like, life is going to be good. And, you know, but, yeah, I think lots of people can earn a living and wear a necktie without destroying the people they care about, like, and putting them at risk. Like, Scully is so, so, like, right on when she says, it's the truth or a white whale, what difference does it make? Both obsessions are impossible to capture, and trying to do so will only leave you dead along with everyone else you bring with you. And she's talking about herself. Like, I know, like, in that moment, I think she's thinking about Ahab, but it's, like, really fortuitous that she's predicting her own future, because Mulder really does kind of drag her down with him. I mean, it's not it's like her choice, like she chooses to go with him and pursue this with him, but still, you know, she's talking about herself and talking about him, and you know, so yeah.
Yeah, I feel like what you said there at the end there is true as well. Like, it is her choice, you know, and she's kind of willingly signed on for the ride after a certain point. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes when people talk about Mulder as this kind of guy who, like, visits all this kind of angst on Scully, you know, because of his quest and so on. I mean, she was a pretty proactive part of it, too, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. Especially in the first season, like Squeeze and Tombs, you know, she's like, I'm going in the car with you. Like, we're doing this together. So, you know, I do appreciate that it is her choice. But yeah, I thought that was really telling that she would say that about him.
Have you guys read Moby Dick by just out of interest?
I've tried.
I've seen the movies, and I've also seen Star Trek 2 and Star Trek First Contact, so I feel like I have a very good grasp of the story.
Well, I've actually, you know, I had a really nice time once where I was, like, between jobs. I had, like, a week where I had nothing to do, basically, because my new job hadn't quite started, and it was the summer, and nobody else was in the house. So I thought, right, I'm going to read Moby Dick, right? So every day for a week, I sat out in my garden and just, like, immersed myself in the book. It's about 1,000 pages or something ridiculous, anyway. And it's really odd because it kind of alternates between the story and, like, really in-depth information about whaling, where you, like, read for, like, 10 pages about harpoons or whatever. And I was just, by the end of it, I knew so much about how to, like, catch whales. It was unreal, you know. And so if anyone wants to tackle the book, I do recommend it. It's hard because it's so antiquated. Because I think some of the characters are like Quakers and so on, where they kind of talk old-fashioned even for the time. So it's a tough read, but yeah, definitely worth picking up. Or watch the movie with Gregory Peck. You could do that instead.
I love Gregory Peck.
Or the TV movie with Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Anyway, the conversation on the rock. In like general, I mean, we've broke it down a bit, but what I really like about it is kind of the simplicity in a way, because it's like a great exploration of Mulder's worldview, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But not only that, but it's like Scully's response to his worldview. And if you think about it, these kind of differences between them, in later seasons, this will be the focus of like an entire episode, won't it? Something like Bad Blood, for example. But I love that it just kind of emerges here quite late in the day in quite a fairly lighthearted romp of an episode, you know. And that, like, if this scene hadn't really worked, it just would have seemed a bit like filler, you know what I mean? Because it's so kind of extended. But no, it just it's marvelous, isn't it? It's the highlight of the episode for me, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to have Mulder and Scully next to each other, just talking to each other for that amount of time was just a dream come true. I mean, like, honestly, I love Mulder and Scully so much that I could just have a whole episode of just them hanging out, like, not doing anything, just talking to each other, and I would love it. Like, that would be, you know, even if they don't do anything romantic at all, they just hang out and talk. Like, that's all I want, really. And, you know, I love the moment at the end when he goes, hell is, he's like, flippant is my favorite quote from Moby Dick. Hell is an idea of firstborn on an undigested apple dumpling. And she makes that face, and it's so adorable, because it's like she's like, Mulder just quoted my favorite book. You know, Mulder's read my favorite book, and he has a line memorized. He has a favorite line. It's like, that's what I feel like is going through her head at that moment. I just love it so much because, you know, it's adorable. Like, that book is so special to her. She read it with her dad, and they had the Ahab and Starbuck thing going on. And so I thought, you know, having Mulder quote that back to her was very special and important.
Yeah, I wonder if he just memorized a few choice quotes.
You know. probably, but, you know, still. Well,
and to your point, Sarah, about them just spending time together and whatnot, I'm not a Mulder and Scully shipper. I will say, I think season 11, if anything, has kind of turned me into one. I liked how it was played that season more than pretty much any other point of the show, with, you know, them being a thing, a relationship, but I've always been, up to that point, I've always been a more platonic shipper of the two of them, and this episode is a great example of that. This whole conversation about bigger issues, you know, about just life in general and all that good stuff. So this is a great win for that as well.
Even if it is just them platonically hanging out, you know, it's just a fun conversation. I just love listening to them talk to each other and, you know, just be friends. talking
well,
about.
Well, I wonder sometimes if we kind of overemphasize the difference between like the shipper camp and the Noromo camp, because I feel like everybody would be into that kind of scene, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Dr. Faraday appears, doesn't he? Just a stone's throw from the shore. They could have walked off the...
Hope
I'm not interrupting anything. And Scully's like, what? And then she goes, we had a little trouble with our boat. I love that she's, like, trying to defend, you know, her father was a freaking sea captain for the United States Navy. And she crashes a boat. And she's like, we had a little trouble with our boat. Like, she's totally embarrassed that she crashed a boat. She's not a Navy sea captain. But, yeah.
I just wanted to say, I mean, you've already mentioned this quote, Sarah.
Yeah.
But, like, here's my parallel with Faraday and Scully again. Like, you know, he says at one point, if a sea monster was here, I would have seen it. I've been working here for 3 years. How long has Scully been assigned to the X-Files at this point? 3 years. So I'm thinking, you know.
Man, you were just really onto this parallel. It's good for you, Carl. That's good. I'm glad you found this recall to the episode that we hadn't found. But that's it. I had not really seen it that way because I saw it. I didn't really, because you, hey, this is a much better way to do it than like, here, guys, here's Miller and Einstein, right? So if you're gonna do parallels, this is how to do it. So good on him in this episode.
The other parallel that I've invented, because it's not really there, but like he's attacked, isn't it? Whereas, you know, Scully often ends up in peril in an episode, but he's the kind of damsel in distress a bit later on, you know.
Mulder has to run off and leave her behind. You know,
the one time where she does not mention that she's a medical doctor, but she takes over.
yes, very good.
It's like
good.
You missed your line, Scully.
I'm a medical doctor. Take a shot every time Scully says that in the show. That's a fun game. You know, mentioning Dr. Faraday real quick, does he not look like Bryan Cranston's brother to y'all?
Yes, like, I can see that.
Did they try to get Bryan Cranston for this? And they're like, all right, he's not. We'll get him down the road. But let's get this guy for now. Like, he really looked like he was related to Bryan Cranston to me. I don't know what it was, but
I could see that. Yeah.
I mean, so what we've what happened is that Mulder kind of realizes that the food chain's been altered because of Faraday's frogs that he's releasing, doesn't he? And this is what's motivated the human attacks, he thinks.
I think that makes sense because in any of these Monster of the Week stories and any kind of genre show, you always wonder, like, okay, this thing's been in secret for decades or centuries, right? But then suddenly there's this, like, barrage of murders or killings or whatever. And you're like, just because our main characters are here now? Is that what the change is? But the explanation here about the food chain and the frogs and all that, it's all very well thought out and, like, perfectly reasonable. Like, I completely buy the logic of Mulder's reasoning here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. And I also like the moment when, like, you know, the sheriff turns up. There's been another attack on the other side of a lake or something. You know, we're deploying all our resources over there. And Mulder's like, no, man, you gotta send them all over this way. But Scully's kind of the sensible kind of peace broker here, isn't she? Where she's like, just give us a couple of men and we'll be all right, you know?
Yeah.
So I liked her kind of playing, you know.
The right approach, because as we're talking about Mulder, he doesn't understand, like, interpersonal relationships. So it takes the Scully touch to get what they need, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, of course, like, Mulder heads off in search of the creature. Eventually, he kind of fires on what turns out to be an alligator, you know? So, I'd love to remember my first viewing of the episode. Like, would I have been surprised? I can't remember. It's been too long, but... I imagine that on first viewing, it would have probably been something that kind of caught people off guard, you know?
Yeah. I was surprised.
I remember the first viewing of this episode. This is back when I was, like, fragmentally watching the X-Files. And I don't know if we were on vacation or something. I feel like we were in, I think it was, like, a hotel room, maybe. I don't know. But I swear, I tuned in, like, right at this time. Like, right when, like, they were talking to the sheriff and the doctor's like, and they find this guy with the leg, and Mulder starts running after, and we see this. I'm like, what? It's an alligator?
And Mulder, he's like, you take care of him, Scully, and just runs away. Classic Mulder.
But it was, I know, right? Mulder, where are you going? But this is, like, the worst episode of the worst time to tune in. I'm like, oh, completely undercut the whole thing. So I never had that, like, oh, it was this the whole time. I do wonder, I should have paid closer attention to, like, Mulder's lips. I feel like... It was almost like an ADR with, like, oh, an alligator. Like, you hear Mulder say it. I feel like that's one of those things you see in TV sometimes. Where, like, we need to really drive the point home. I don't think people at home are going to understand. We need someone to say that this was an alligator. Because people might think, oh, well, that must be the sea monster, right? That must be their special effect interpretation of what it looks like. So I feel like they put that in there specifically to tell everyone, this is not a plesiosaur. It's an alligator. And also, and last thing I'll say about this is, Mulder, the whole episode he's talking about, this is an earth-shattering discovery. Right? This could change the way we see evolution, right? He sees it, and he immediately just starts shooting at it. He's like, shoot, shoot, shoot.
that's what I thought, too.
I'm glad I wasn't alone in that.
Yeah, well, that's really in character, I think, because, like, do you remember, like, in Little Green Men, where he's gone to the Puerto Rico Observatory or whatever, and he sees, like, the alien figure in the doorway, and again, he just goes for the gun there, doesn't he? So, no, it's definitely true.
Yeah.
We come in peace, shoot to kill.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how he hangs his head at the, like, after he kills the alligator, and he's just like, oh, man, like, I really wanted it to be Big Blue. It's just so pitiful. So sad.
Well, yeah, because Scully says to him, like, you know, you slewed a big white whale, Ahab.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's so disappointed. He's kind of crestfallen, isn't he? But he wanted Big Blue to be real. He says, I guess I see hope in such a possibility, doesn't he? And Scully says, people want to believe.
Yes. Yes. I love that scene and that exchange between those two because, I mean, it's like she's really trying to kind of comfort him, I think. She knows how disappointed he is. Yeah. You know, poor Mulder, but I think she comforts him a lot better than he comforts her when Queequeg gets eaten. But yeah, also one thing I didn't notice before, I was watching with the captions, because I usually do, but the guys in the truck, when they're backing up, one of the guys yells, "All right, Darren, go ahead." I thought that was a nice shout out to Darren Morgan.
did not notice that.
Yep.
Did not
good
notice
catch.
That.
It's there. No. Yeah, so.
Right. So what about, guys, what about this last sighting of Big Blue then? So the argument against it would be like, you don't need to show Big Blue. You know, you could have had the episode end where, you know, Scully's kind of right. It wasn't a monster or whatever. It was just the alligator that was at work. Does it undercut the drama? You know, would this have been a worse episode if the monster didn't appear?
I don't know. I think there's arguments for both sides.
I mean, you could have done it like you just saw a ripple on the surface of the water or something, couldn't you?
I think it makes the episode. I do. I think that whole little wrinkle, like, it's like, oh, okay. But, you know, that again, like being in a Darren Morgan style kind of episode, right? It's like you have the fake aliens, then the real alien as well, or something like that, right? Or you have the robotic cockroaches from an alien planet, or just normal cockroaches, right? So you have this. There's always these baits and switches and whatnot, and I really like. I think that brought it all home, like Mulder, right? It's like he sits and he's just standing there. Who knows how long he's been standing there looking at the lake after this, right? Because the whole conversation Scully is with him. He's still just standing there looking at the lake. He's still standing there, and Scully, you know, eventually he's like, all right. We're done here. He leaves. And the minute he turns around and leaves, the monster comes up and just for a second and goes back down. Like, that is Mulder's life. That it is, right? That he was so close to the truth, and yet he just missed it. And I do see the value in maybe, again, having some episodes that are more ambiguous, and then also maybe some where, frankly, there was nothing. Like, Scully was right the whole time. Like, as you guys said, like, that would have been cool to show more of that, because maybe they needed that to kind of balance it out, because it did become a trope where, like, Scully thinks this, Mulder thinks that, Scully's wrong, Mulder's right, the whole episode is the journey to him, you know, getting his crazy theory confirmed, and maybe sometimes she'll see something, but probably not, so they still have their little thing at the end where, you're a skeptic and I'm a believer, right? So, if they had thrown in a few more episodes where, like, yeah, there was nothing to this other than just the natural world and science, that would have been fine, but I love this episode the way it is so much with the sea monster at the end. I 100% love what they did, and I'm for it.
Yeah, no, I am as well. Like, I know I put the opposing case, I just wanted to give voice to it, but no, I agree. I like the way the episode is. I wouldn't want to change it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything else, like, Sarah, you wanted to bring up based on your notes or whatever before we get onto, like, the mailbag and stuff like that?
Mostly just that one of the reasons that I enjoy this episode so much, I think, is because it really taught me a lot about storytelling, and helped me in my journey to become a writer, because it does have a little bit of everything. It's got, you know, the suspense and the humor, and I try to include all of that in my writing, but I guess I enjoy it so much because it's the one that I kind of studied when I was trying to learn how to write and teach myself these, you know, how to, you know, end a chapter with a suspenseful moment, you know, somebody getting eaten or whatever. So, I mean, I think that's why this episode is really special to me because it really, I mean, it is sort of, I say textbook, but I mean that in a positive way. It's really something that I could learn from and that I have learned from. And it's something that I go back to often when I need inspiration or just to, you know, hang out and watch a good episode of TV.
I think that's a nice note to end on, Sarah. But, I mean, listeners, stay tuned because this is the end of our in-depth look at the episode, but we do have more to come. Now then, Zach, you specifically requested, didn't you, that you wanted to be asked the question, do you believe in, on this podcast? So, Zach Moore, do you believe in sea monsters, lake monsters, however you want to put it?
This is a tough question, you know, because as I referenced earlier, like, that's what got me into this whole, like, thing, you know, into stuff like The X-Files and stuff like, you know, Unsolved Mysteries and Search Stuff, that kind of thing. And, you know, it was an Unsolved Mysteries segment. It's about Lake Champlain, and they had this picture of Champ, the Lake Champlain monster, and it is the best picture of a lake monster or a sea monster ever. Like, it looks like a dinosaur in this lake, you know? And it's just one picture, and there's not a lot of context around it, but no one has really proved what it is or what it isn't. So that alone just ignited the imagination, like a five-year-old me, and I've been on this whole, like, you know, interested in this Mulder quest, right? Not really, but, you know, just interested in this kind of stuff. So I think if you really had to be like, all right, comes down to it, do you believe this stuff or not? I'd say lake monsters, unfortunately, I'm going to have to say no, honestly, because it's a lake, you know, there's people live around the lake. Like it's only so big. If it's the kind of animals we think, then they have to come up to breathe, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, I think there's stuff going on. I think there's a lot of misidentifications, right? I think, you know, people that aren't familiar see, like, they see a swan, like, from like 1,000 feet away. Right. I mean, seriously, like, they don't know. You see an elk, you see a seal, you know, sometimes you're connected to that. I think, you know, eels, you know, moray eels can get really long, especially if they, like, get trapped in an environment where they don't go breed. I think they keep growing bigger and bigger. So I think there's a lot of underwater things that could be bigger fish, you know. So I think it's a combination of logs, right? Who knows, right? Hoaxes, you know, people are always trying to. So it's a really intricate thing. But I think, unfortunately, lake monsters, there might be some sort of unknown fish or eel or squid or something, right? But are there plesiosaurs or aquatic dinosaurs living in the world today? Unfortunately, I'm going to say no, I don't think so. Now the open ocean, who knows what's out there, right? Again, yeah. I don't think there might be, like, plesiosaurs and stuff, but I think there might be things that we don't know yet, because we've, as you hear in all these specials all the time, right, about the unexplained, we know more about the surface of the moon than the bottom of the ocean, right? So I think there is still hope, because I want to believe in these things, and I do. I'm totally Mulder in this category. So I think lake monsters are no for aquatic dinosaurs. I think on the open ocean, who knows what's out there? So that's my take.
I would love nothing more than to find out that, like, the Loch Ness Monster or something was real. I just don't see it happening, you know. I think that, like you say, I think species that we're not aware of is entirely possible. Something that of this size, you know, and heft, I don't think that's going to happen. But, I mean, Sarah, how about you? Do you believe in this stuff?
I'm with Zach. I want to believe. Yeah, and I have, it's been a lot of fun for me. I mean, not to, like, self-promote or anything, but in my book that I'm writing now, I have an aquatic menace story in my book. It's a throwback to King Arthur and some of his adventures in the supernatural world. And there's this one story in North Wales called the Afanc, I think. I'm not totally sure how to pronounce it, A-F-A-N-A-C, but so it's a fun story to research, and there's all these tales about how it would eat cows, and they, you know, tried to sacrifice a virgin to it one time and chained her up to a tree or something and tried to lure it out so they could kill it. And, you know, all these stories go back so far and for so long that it's interesting to think about and to hope for that something out there like that could exist. But it really probably is just a crocodile or an alligator. But yeah
on that note, let's have a look at what our listeners said about Quagmire, because popular episode, so plenty of people chipped in on this one. I'll start with a couple of people who weren't as keen on it. So Adam Silver said, "This is one I didn't know there was such love for until later. Outside of the conversation on the rock, I don't think it's great, and the end is hokey. I actually remember this being an episode I had to apologise for to a new viewer to convince them to keep watching." Michael Little said, "Good episode with one truly great scene. On the other hand, I have never gotten the hype. Much prefer Detour to this." Anyway, so so those two guys weren't as keen on it, but Cortland likes it. She said, "This one makes my top 20 easily because it's a really nice blend of quirky case file and character development. I think it's also a rare instance where the X-Files tackles a mythological beast and gets a good episode out of it. I tend to favour more light-hearted episodes, and I think in spite of the dark atmosphere and the death of Porkwigweg, this is one of them. Also, of course, the conversation on the rock is one of my favourite Mulder and Scully conversations, right up there with, her name is Bambi, in this season."
Yay, Cortland. Agree.
Yeah.
Yep.
And a couple of other really positive people. So Andrew Blake said, "Great episode, it's fun, and the rock convo, of course, is superb." And Katie Doe said, "It's the first episode I ever saw, and it obviously got me hooked." Pun
Yay.
Intended.
Yeah.
Ew.
That's my kind of pun.
It's a great first episode. I'm jealous, Katie.
So yeah, no, it's definitely a firm fan favourite. That's how it seems, isn't it?
Yeah.
I got a few more. Matt Conrad said, "Quagmire has always been one of my favourites. I always come back to it when I can't seem to decide which episode to watch. To me, it's quintessential X-Files. Mystery, investigation, monsters, and a remote location. The cinematography is great, particularly at the end as Mulder walks off into the foggy shadows of the forest. It's just an iconic shot, much like Deep Throat walking off into the fog at the end of EBE. Oh, and hashtag Porkwigweg." In terms of what he says about, you know, I can't decide to what to watch, I just put Quagmire on, I definitely get that.
Yeah, that's my go-to. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Because it's so self-contained, because it's got so many quirky little lines and stuff, I suppose, Zach, isn't it? That's probably what gives it the rewatch value.
Yeah, it's just nice, easy watching X-Files. You know, feel good. It's not heavy. It's not bogged down a lot of heavy mythology. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to, like, it doesn't feel like that's part of a greater whole. Like, it's a complete piece. It stands on its own, and is always, despite a dog being killed in it, other than that, it's a nice, it's a nice fun X-Files. I harp on the dog. Who? Several people die as well.
But, I mean, no, yeah, who cares about people? The, dogs, like, here. 5-6 humans that get eaten? It's fine.
Exactly.
They're just humans.
That's the thing. Massacre, like, 100 people. I'm like, oh, okay, that's the movies, right? You kill one dog, I'm like, this is an outrage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just going to say, in terms of the body count, this must be up there with, like, you know, it's probably not the highest, but it must be fairly high up because, yeah, plenty of people get offed in this one, don't they?
Mm-hmm. That alligator was just hungry.
Yeah. Right, let me give you a comment from Marlene, which is a little bit longer, but it's good stuff. So she said, "I started paying closer attention to Quagmire 4 years ago. It's great to watch for whimsical fun or to look more deeply. I think the crux of the episode is at least four important conversations. The car, the boat, the rock, for sure. They're sort of a progressive discussion of expectation, hope, and belief. Mulder and Scully are both stuck, quagmired, if you will. Scully laments the loss of a normal life through the ultimately mundane death of her dog. She's overly attached to the way things aren't. Mulder pines after the supernatural and dismisses anything that's not fantastic. For example, disdaining the dog and being disappointed by the alligator while being fascinated by the lake monster. I love the ending, showing that mysteries still remain, even if explanations require concrete solutions. Also, who can't adore the quirky cast of characters? The curmudgeonly scientist, the bumbling photographer, the trickster shopkeeper, the half-eaten Boy Scout troop leader, and certainly, and not least, the sheriff. Quagmire is a wonderful character piece that has entertained me more and more as the years go by." So yeah, I mean, I like the way she puts that in terms of the progression of the conversations, which I hadn't really considered, but... No, she's touched on a lot of stuff that we've kind of gone over as well, but she's like kind of crystallized it quite nicely there, I think.
Yeah, the whole structure of like the progression of Mulder and Scully's conversations is great. And I don't know if that was planned or not, or a happy accident, but that totally tracks with me. I buy it.
Yeah.
And I like that because one of the things with like the Lost Art of Forehead Sweat is you get these long scenes that are, you know, there's a succession of scenes in the car park where... I like the fact here you've got a bit of variety, like we said, the car, the boat, the rock, the shore.
Mm.
You know? So,
The car park, the car park, the car park, the car park.
That's
great
it.
Progression.
That's it. Right, just two more before we wrap up, I guess. So Edin Dumsich said, "It's one of those feel-good episodes that I return to again and again. I just love it. It's great fun with just the right balance of quirkiness and mystery. The entire episode is a great Mulder and Scully showpiece, but the famous conversation on the rock is one of the series highlights. Kim Newton's got the credit, but Darren Morgan's fingerprints are obviously all over the episode, and it's all the better for it. Also, I would say it's one of the best examples of the Vancouver mood. And I think we agree based on what we've said. And last, but by no means least, is Dina Ferrari, who said, I like that the monster turns out to be something non-paranormal. Mulder couldn't possibly be right all the time, but he's right almost all the time. There are several episodes, for example, when the X-Files have been closed, that start out non-paranormal and then get weirder and spookier and turn out to be X-Files. I like this, which is the other way around. Poor Queequeg, though.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's what I was trying to say earlier. That's a great point of like, it'd be nice to have some just for variety's sake and for balance's sake that are not always something supernatural paranormal.
Yeah, I did appreciate that twist in this episode because, you know, it's always fun to try to figure out when I'm telling stories, you know, I try to find out a nice blend. And it's probably because of this episode, you know, I want to find out, I want to have a rational explanation along with the possibility of something supernatural or otherworldly, you know, in my story. So I think it's, I mean, clearly this episode has had a huge influence on me in my life. But yeah, so I do like that it is the alligator eating the people, but then you've got the other couple of things that happen throughout the episode that's possibly Big Blue, which is why I do like that they show Big Blue at the end, because you're like, oh, yep, mm-hmm, the truth is out there. And it does give you reason to cheer for Mulder that he does have hope. And I feel like if it was just, if we didn't see Big Blue at the end, I feel like we'd just be like almost kind of as disappointed as Mulder. But having Big Blue there, you're like, oh, yeah, it's like that last little wink for the audience. And I really appreciate that. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. It's like he's got the hope that kind of comes from within. You know, we know he'll kind of pick himself up and dust himself down and get on with it again. And like, but like the audience has seen Big Blue, and that kind of gives us hope in a weird way. I don't know. But yeah, no, I like that. I like that taking it.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Because it gives you the, it doesn't make you feel like his whole life is for what? You know, kind of like they're talking about on the rock. Like what are we even doing? What have we accomplished? You know, it's like, well, look, there's stuff out there. We should keep looking. We'll find it.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think we should leave the lake monsters for today. So before we go there, I mean, Zach, do you want to take it first? I mean, what else have you been up to online? I know you got the Smallville podcast and some stuff you've been doing with Brandon. What do you want to kind of point people towards?
Yeah, so I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always on the Smallville. You can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S, and we talk about each and every episode of the Young Superman show from the 2000s. And also, I'm the host of Standard Orbit, a Star Trek original series podcast. You can find me on the Trek FM network over there at Trek FM on Twitter. We talk about all things old and new, Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. And I do have a limited run podcast called Halloween H4O with fellow ex-cast contributor Brandon Shea Mattel. We're talking about the entire Halloween franchise from the first one all the way up to Halloween, which is an odd title for a reboot sequel. But anyway, from Halloween to Halloween, we're talking about all the every film in the franchise over there on the Talk Film Society. And you can find us over there at Talk Film Society on Twitter.
Great stuff. And Sarah, how about you? What are you up to these days? Where can people find you?
Always in the basement.
Yeah.
I'm over on Twitter mostly at Sarah, SARAHLBLAIR, Sarah L. Blair. I've got a book out that's called Darkness Shifting that I wrote. There's lots of little X-Files Easter eggs in there that I've hidden around because it's my favorite show, in case you didn't know. So, it's a fun book, fun read. That's pretty much all I've got going on. Some things that are going on behind the scenes.
Ooh.
That are going to be fun, that I hope will happen next year. So, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Sarah, I have one last thing. I could not let this episode go without asking you. This is your favorite episode of The X-Files, is it not?
Yep. Yep. Okay. I'm going to go with yes. And yes.
And who does not appear in this episode?
I know. Amazing, right?
If you put Skinner in the Queequeg role, you know, it could have been a nice kind of send-off for him, you know?
Oh, don't ruin this episode.
You actually just made me choke.
you know, you could he'd be on the back seat of the car in the opening scene. Fit quite nicely, wouldn't it, really?
I think Skinner would have the sense to not get eaten, though. Just saying.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Mulder. Skinner really needs to go for a walk. I'll be right back.
Yeah, all those Scully Skinner shippers, you know, would be excited.
Gotta go walk the talk.
On that note. Anyway, guys, I think in terms of the X-Cast, I mean, it's all the usual places. Tony will be along in a minute to tell you about them, to tell you about the Patreon and all that stuff. So Twitter at @X_cast, Facebook at the X-Files Basement. But until next time, always remember, show us your bobbers.
The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @WeMadeThisPod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Movie Palace.
Yeah, I can remember my first viewing of The Sound of Music quite distinctly, actually, because it was 8 days ago.
You've never seen it before that?
8 days ago was the first time I'd sat down to watch it from start to finish. Now, I always associate The Sound of Music. It's interesting that you both talk about it as an Easter thing. It is associated with bank holidays here, but I don't think it's just Easter. So I had seen a lot of these sequences. I think if I was inside on a bank holiday when I was a child and The Sound of Music was on, it was normally a bad thing because it meant it was raining and I couldn't go out and play football.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
I've got 5 tattoos. So I started getting tattoos when I was about 5 years ago, and it was just sort of one by one, I guess. So not huge coverage, but I'm definitely got the bug, so to speak. So, but the latest one is the Red Dwarf one. Yeah,
and that's the one you've decided to talk about today. Describe it for me.
Yeah.
Free with this month's issue.
Obviously, you must remember the sign in musical exchanges.
I do indeed.
Do not play. Yeah. There was a few riffs, weren't there, that you weren't allowed to play? This being top of them.
Enter Sandman, Smoke on the Water, Stairway to Heaven, anything widdly above the 12th fret, I think that song said.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that paid no attention to that shit. Remember when we almost got thrown out for playing with that delay pedal?
Yes.
It was amazing.
I also remember the day that I went in with my birthday money to Musical Exchanges to buy a pedal, and I ended up buying the Boss Hyper Metal, and I was insisting to the bloke that I was buying it from. I was like, I don't really play much metal, I just like the sound of it. I want to use it for sort of, you know, more experimental sounds. Like, you're wearing a Metallica t-shirt.
I'm not that into metal, actually. I want to do something more like Swans with it, like My Bloody Valentine, that kind of thing.
Which I did, but I was wearing a Metallica t-shirt at the time.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.